Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. Then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk.
Good evening and happy Shabbat. It's with great pleasure I tell you that I was able to lure our mutual friend Kirk to paradise, and that having spent 2 years living on Kara, that Kirk is right now camped out in my sky office at the top of Kara. Yes, and that I have been elevated here to Shamaim, which is probably 100 feet above Kara, and looking down over Kara. So I am looming down over you, Kirk, as I sit. Yeah, sitting here in our home above the marina, looking down over you. But yes, we are both coming to you, suffering greatly here in the U.S. Virgin Islands. It is, as you have found, Kirk, a little primitive here. We don't have all of the accoutrements of the continental U.S., but it is a really marvelous life. There's wonderful people here, great friendships to be had. People are just approachable, unpretentious. The island is beautiful. The pace of it is charming. It is a lovely place.
It is. I like it very much.
Yeah. So what we're going to do today is we're going to jump ahead into what is now volume 2 of the Mikre, which is actually volume 5 overall of the Yada Yahweh series. It'll be called Appointments. As a bit of news, the previous volume called Mikre, this is now Moed, but Mikre, Invitations of the Yada Yahweh series, is now available at Amazon. I received my first copies here today. They are really beautiful. Thank you, Jackie. Probably my favorite book now of the series. It is a longer one compared to some of the others, because God has a lot to say about the first three Moed Mikre. And it's just filled with all sorts of new insights and all new translations, and it's a marvelous read. So for those who are interested, it is available at Amazon. Also, and it's Mikre Invitations. Also, I want to bring everybody's attention once again to yadaya.davidsgod.com. yadaya.davidsgod.com. It is where David and Scott have put together the website that is a perfect match now for the books. It's all the same consistent look. It's a marvelously interactive site that has everything that we have written and rewritten available at your fingertips. There's a whole bookshelf of all of the books, including the most recent one, Invitations, all there for free. And I think beautifully presented, exceedingly easy to navigate. And just beautiful. Very, very pleased with it. All right. In the middle of this, what is beginning now, will be the third chapter of Moed Appointments, volume 5 of the Yada Yah series. I have finished a review of what the fourth Moed Mikre represents by this time. And I had in a previous volume then transitioned into the fulfillment of the Moed as it's chronicled in the book of Acts with the Shimon talking to the people and telling the people what happened. And, you know, I'm embarrassed to tell you that as I did that, I was convinced that Shimon had, who is now known as Peter, had done a marvelous job of citing things and making his case for Yosha and who Yosha was and what he represents. And I want to tell you, it would be hard to have been more wrong than I was. It wasn't spoken by Shimon. The whole thing was made up by Luke on behalf of Paul, and it is an abomination from beginning to end. They didn't get anything right. So, leading up to this, we know that Pesach Passover is Yahweh's means to elongate our days. It is to provide a life everlasting for his sons and daughters, for the members of his family. And it is with him providing the sacrificial lamb. Yahweh, a soul, resided within Yosha so that he himself could endure all of the pain of that sacrifice. And then matzah is the process of Yahweh removing religion and politics from us. It is defined literally by Yahweh removing us and his children from Mitzrayim, withdrawing us from the stain and stigma, the malignancy of religion and politics, so that we can appear perfect in Yahweh's eyes. Bukurim is then about our adoption into God's family, and for him opening the doors to heaven, and not only allowing us in, but allowing us in as his children. Then Shavuah, which follows 7 sevens thereafter, the purpose of Shavuah is so that God's covenant children grow, so that we're enlightened and empowered and enriched, such that we become not only far more interesting to our Creator, just as those who have had children know that, well, children are charming and cute and lovable when they're, before they learn to speak and before they walk, you know, as they approach 2 years old. From that point on, where they can choose where they want to be, because they can crawl or walk, and they can respond to you in speaking, the enjoyment of that relationship grows exponentially. So we are much more interesting to God as we grow from babies into young men and women in his family. And as growing adults into his family, we are prepared in Shavuah by being enlightened, being enriched, being empowered, so that we can take some responsibility. Because the first four Mikre, Yahweh is doing everything for us. On the fifth Mikre, we have an opportunity to do something in return, which is to share his message, to cast out a warning as to people going in the wrong direction who are involved in religion and politics, and to tell people there's a better way, the Yahweh's way, where we walk away from such things. And we capitalize on the terms and conditions of the covenant. We capitalize on each of the seven Moed Mikre. Trust in his Torah. Come to know God and appreciate what he's offering and respect what he's asking in return. So that ultimately Yahweh can reconcile his relationship with Yisrael and Yehudim, and that we're given the opportunity to camp out with him collectively for all eternity. And, you know, having added a new book to our shelf, today and now looking at what is, every bit of 2 feet of books just from the spine. I can't imagine that Yeah was not anything other than thrilled with what we have accomplished together and the benefit it will have for his people. And we have so little time left and can make such a wonderful difference on the richness of the eternal experience in heaven that this has become such a wonderful experience and labor of love. And as we continue through the Moed and doing Shavua for Volume 5, I made the transition into covering Act 2. And this is how it begins. It is with considerable trepidation that we venture into the pages of the Christian New Testament. And yet Shimon's accounting of the fulfillment of Shavua in 33 CE may be worth the risk. Having lived alongside Yosha for 3 years and having been in Jerusalem during the Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim experience, the disciple would have been prepared by the first three mikrei to capitalize upon the fourth, Shavua. He had been in the right place for the right reasons at the right time with the correct expectations. As a beneficiary of Passover, unyeasted bread, and firstborn children, he would soon be enriched by the covenant. He'd be enlightened by the Torah, and he'd be empowered by the Spirit, causing him to be a more effective witness. In the opening line of the second chapter of the book of Acts, we see that the Mikra of Shavua, like the three preceding it, was fulfilled in accordance with Yahweh's Torah instructions. This known, understand that Acts, like the Gospel of Luke, is a work of fiction, far more wrong than right. Neither book was inspired by God. And while they purport to be historical documents scribed towards the conclusion of the lifetimes of the eyewitnesses to the events they chronicle, both books were heavily influenced by Shaul, the plague of death. It is only because the first seven chapters of Acts precede Paul and attempt to convey the testimony of Yosha's disciples, especially Shimon, that any of this is presented for your consideration. With this in mind, the second chapter of Acts begins. Indeed, on the day of 50, and of course from 50, Kirk, we get the Pentecost, don't we? Yeah, Pentecost. Well. Yeah. Feminine for Pente Junta, meaning 50. And it says it was fulfilled. Yeah, it's amazing that Christians will transliterate the word for 50 in Greek and celebrate Pentecost. But they won't acknowledge Shavua. You were in the Christian church for a while. Do you ever have a pastor say, next week we're going to be celebrating Shavua? It's the promise of the Shabbat.
No, even if they told it, they would have not acknowledged it, and they'd still, even if they told you what they were, that was for Jews.
Yeah, that was the Jewish thing. Well, yeah, so yeah. They Christianized it by calling it Pentecost. God does not have a Pentecost celebration. It came to exist that all assembled in harmony in the presence of it. So it came to exist that all assembled in harmony in the presence of it. You know, auto, which is it, is a neuter noun, a singular pronoun, because unlike Hebrew, where ruach, spirit, is a feminine noun, in Greek, phenoma is neuter. And while it sounds odd to our ear to refer to our spiritual mother as it rather than she or her, such as the liability of Greek compared to Hebrew and with regard to spiritual understanding, when Yahweh speaks about Shavua, he constantly reinforces that it's a meeting with him and that it celebrates the empowerment and the enrichment and the enlightenment of his firstborn children. In fact, firstborn children, Bakudam and Shabua, are constantly interwoven and woven together and spoken of as one flowing into the other and being inseparable. But here, nope, it was Pentecost Day, and all assembled were in harmony and presence of it. Not with, not with the set-apart spirit. Not in harmony with Bakudam, not in harmony with the Torah, just with it.
It.
And immediately there came into existence out of heaven the sound of information and news echoes like a compelling force, moving inwardly and upholding the breath of spiritual life, fulfilling the whole household where they were residing. And languages became apparent to them like a fire burning in them, and they were distributed, conferred and appointed upon each one of them. And they were all individually filled with the separate spirit and began to speak other languages, just as the spirit gave them the ability to enlighten through the spoken word. So let's say this happened. I don't doubt that it is quite possible that the Spirit would have given the disciples and those who were the beneficiaries of Pesach, Matzah, Makorim the ability to speak in the languages of the communities that were in and around Israel, of which there are really only three languages that you would need to speak to be able to converse with everyone that was there. They would be, in counting Hebrew, would be four, but Hebrew, Aramaic, which was the language of Mesopotamia, the language of Babylon and Assyria, Greeks who had conquered this place and so many others, and Latin, the Roman language. If you spoke Latin and or Greek and or any one of the Aramaic dialects, which is very similar to Hebrew, you'd pretty much have it nailed. But while the ability to speak languages is important in communicating God's message, what they didn't mention here is what's far more important than that. What good is it to be trilingual or quadlingual or any other lingual if you don't know what to say? Why not first say they were given an understanding of how the Torah was fulfilled such that they could convey this useful information to people in the languages they spoke?
That would be logical.
Just the fact, that you can speak another language doesn't mean that you make any more sense in it than you do in any other language.
You can lie on all four.
So whoever wrote this missed what was important and just wallowed all over the fact that they were able to speak different languages. But listen, that's not a miracle. Do you know that the preponderance of people of any substance spoke multiple languages?
Mm-hmm.
Those who spoke Latin could converse with those who spoke Hebrew, who could converse with those who spoke Aramaic, who could converse with those who spoke Greek, because those four languages were spoken throughout the known world.
Everywhere.
Yeah. It doesn't mean that many of them spoke the Germanic languages. That would have been very rare. But they all spoke those four languages, and that was enough to reach most of the enlightened world. But what good was it if they didn't start with the purpose of Shabua, which is to enlighten us so that we would understand how this relates to the fulfillment of the Torah and to the enablement of the covenant's promises? That's why I'm just so frustrated when you even read something that has, yeah, well, speaking different languages, that has merit. Certainly plays into our hands where we're conveying God's message in the language more Jews speak than any other, English.
Right. Yes.
But it doesn't help if you aren't first given an understanding. And when you consider even the disciples, they were quasi-dunderheads all the way up to the fulfillment of Passover, and they weren't all that bright afterwards. I mean, remember, he had this alleged conversation with Shimon. It didn't actually take place, where Shimon is saying, God forbid you're going to Jerusalem. You're not going to do any of that stuff. This fulfillment of the Mikra, that's nonsense. I mean, come on. These guys didn't seem to get any of it. And then they're all, if you can believe the text, they're all huddled in the upper room. And Yosha, walked through the walls and said, howdy, fellas. And they don't even know who he is. So,
most unlikely.
Yeah, they were not inspired like Dote. To compare any of these numbskulls to Dote would be a great crime. But nonetheless, this is what we were allegedly told happened, and part of it has some merit. The world would benefit from understanding the Moed testimony on the enduring appointments, which are Mikra invitations to be called out as needed. And the only way for people around the globe to understand what the Torah teaches would be through accurate translations. They didn't all speak Hebrew. This is true even today. And that's largely why Yada Yahwa exists. We recognize the value of rendering the testimony Yahwa conveyed in Hebrew in the language just known and spoken by men. The most universal. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, but more important, the way you have written from day one is you give us all the clues in Hebrew, so even people who don't speak Hebrew, of which I probably couldn't go to the store and buy groceries, I can look up every word that was spoken in the Torah. I can try to examine every one of those things. So it's written in English, but all the information in Hebrew is right there. Yes, if you take
and it's from a Hebrew mindset. Yeah. Probably the thing that has made the biggest difference in time of doing this is the ability to think in Hebrew. So that when we're doing the translations and writing the commentary, we're doing so from the perspective of the Hebrew language, from what the Hebrew terms mean and the relationships and the volition and the conjugations and just the terminology, the whole mindset that's conveyed by the infinite nature of Hebrew verbs. We come at all of this from a Hebrew perspective and then discuss those Hebrew terms in the language that's most understood by people in the world. We really are working very hard to have a Hebrew mindset. Now, if it were not for the popularity of the Pentecostal movement, where speaking in tongues is interpreted to be praising God in heavenly languages, we would not be required to state the obvious. The spirit of seven sevens empowered those who observe Shavuot to enlighten others by speaking their languages, not God's. They wouldn't need any help if they were going to be speaking God's language, because all the people there were Hebrews, and they spoke Hebrew. So they were already speaking the language of heaven.
Very good, very good.
Yeah. The language spoken in heaven is Hebrew, rendering the notion of speaking in the tongues of angels by muttering incomprehensible gibberish as nonsensical as the sounds themselves. What's more, they appear to be out of their minds. The people who advocate this, and they have no credibility. And the worst thing that the religious people do is they pretend to be talking about God, and yet they're making absolute idiots of themselves. And so they're undermining their positions. By the way, speaking of idiots of themselves, Mike, who is the fact checker of the Yada Yada series, does a marvelous job. He sent me an article that was done. It's not a large base study, less than 500 people, I think, part of the study. University of Oregon or Oregon State, one of those two universities, did a study on those who were involved in conspiracies. And what they found is that those who are involved in conspiracies are worse than just losers. You know, all the studies up to this point said if you're promoting conspiracies, the one common denominator is that you've got a crappy life and you're trying to find other people to blame for your crappy life because you don't want to take responsibility for it. And that's the universal common denominator amongst most people that advance conspiracies. Their lives are unsatisfactory. They want someone to blame. And they come up with a conspiracy to blame others. This is far more sinister. It says that, you know, the people that are promoting conspiracies have a tendency to be narcissists, to be psychopaths, to be highly troubled individuals that that have really a dark side to them. So what we saw with the conspiratorial type that were once affiliated with this program is they are very, very troubled individuals. It appears, therefore, that Yahweh fulfilled the Mikra of Shavuah by dispatching the set apart spirit to equip his children to be more effective communicators. What is not true, however, is what follows. It was scribed by Luke on Paul's behalf to besmirch Jews. For his new religion to prevail, Yehudim would have to be swept off center stage and replaced by the Gentile church. Now, as we go through Acts 2, what we're going to find is something so compelling, is why I wanted to go into this. I was found evidence elsewhere that Paul and his pal Luke and then their pal Mark and then their pal Matthew had come up with this scheme of transferring every promise made to Dod to Yosha, recognizing that Dod's everything. He's the Son of God. He's the Messiah. He's the King of Kings. He's the embodiment of the second coming. He's the chosen one. He's the prophet. He's everything. And Yosha is just the Passover lamb. You can't make a religion out of the Passover lamb. So what you have to do is say, well, there's no prophecies about the Passover lamb that says the Passover lamb is anything more than the Passover lamb. And so the only way to make the Passover lamb look like, well, he is the end-all and be-all, is to take every promise that was made to the end-all and be-all, Dod, and rip them from him and say, ah, they weren't really talking about Dod. Just because they call him Dod doesn't really mean he's Dod. There was really...
That's phenomenal, though.
Yes. And so what we're going to find...
Every time you see it says Dod. And they say it's not.
Yes. Yeah, of course, 2 Samuel 7 is one of my favorite. We're going to get to it, where it says this is about Dod. And they said, no, that's about Jesus. And then we're going to go to Psalm 110. Psalm 110 is the most quoted psalm throughout the Christian New Testament. And it says, it's proof that Dod's not in heaven and that the Lord Jesus Christ is there and that therefore there is a Trinity and that this is speaking of our Lord. But it begins, this is a psalm regarding Dod. And then it goes and talks about Dod. Part of this, don't you get, folks? Oh, anyway, and what we're going to find is that Acts 2 exists for a singular purpose. That is to rob Dod of all the promises God made to him, to give the Christian Jesus credibility that he does not deserve, that is inappropriate, by ascribing all of those promises to him. And then once you've taken everything from God's chosen, the Messiah, the Son of God, and giving it to this religious icon, Jesus Christ, then you just fill it by filling the rest by saying the Jews are really bad. They irked God. God decided that he didn't like them anymore. And he is now going to form a relationship with the Gentile church and do exactly what he told his people not to do. So the story goes. So, and now existing inside Jerusalem resided Yehudim, Iudios, Jews, overtly pious men from every ethnicity under heaven. Okay, before we go to the second part of that statement, where's the flaw here? That there were Yehudim, pious men from every ethnicity under heaven. There's a couple of flaws just in that statement. Isn't Yehudim Jew an ethnicity? Isn't Yehudim an ethnicity? A very specific ethnicity represent something around 0.1% of the world's population.
Yes.
Okay. So Yehudim is an ethnicity. How can Yehudim be from every ethnicity? Isn't every ethnicity other than Yehudim Goyim?
Yeah, Goy.
Okay, so he could say in Jerusalem or Goyim of every ethnicity, but he says no, Yehudim of every ethnicity. That's so dumb.
Jews of every ethnicity.
Okay, and then the second part of that is, at this point of time, let's just forget about you said Yehudim. Let's just say that there were every ethnicity under heaven. Well, did they have Mayans there? Aztecs? Incas?
Chinese.
Were there Gauls there at the time? Germanic tribes? The Norse? Were the Ruskies there? Chinese?
Ruskies.
Indians?
South Americans.
South America. Wait, come on. Please.
Aborigines.
Won't you tell me how that's
Australia.
And how can you be Australian? How could you be a Christian theologian and see that and not recognize there's two fundamental flaws in that statement alone? And how can this be the inerrant word for God when there's two massive errors in the first statement? And now existing inside of Jerusalem resided Yehudim, Jews, overtly pious men from every ethnicity under heaven. Oh, by the way, if you think I'm making a mistake in saying ethnicity, the Greek word for ethnicity is?
Ethnos.
Ethnos. Where do you think we get the English word ethnicity?
Pretty damn close.
Yeah, do you think the English word for ethnicity is might be from ethnos?
I think it's a good one.
And now when this voice came to exist in large assemblies of people, they were confused because each and every one heard what was spoken in his own language. Well, folks, as is the case with much of the Christian New Testament, the writer's attempts to paint the Jews as conniving and undeserving is pathetic. Yahud Jew is a unique ethnicity, just as we shared, and it is the antithesis of being from every race under heaven.
It's set apart.
Yeah, every race under heaven, that would be Goyim. It would have been impossible for them to have been a gathering representing every race on earth in this place at this time. Further, just pointing out the obvious, people are confused by languages they do not speak and not by their native tongue. Yes, I know I'm just pointing out what we should all be able to determine. And yet without someone having done so, billions upon billions have been misled by this malarkey for nearly a score of centuries. Now, lucky for me, and probably for you, Kirk, we don't live under the influence of the Roman Catholic Church. Given the opportunity, they would have tortured us to death as a deterrent to keep others from telling you the truth. And yet, sadly, today, they're busy tormenting little children instead.
Yeah, well, that's sick. Yes.
It is bewildering that so many believe, bewildering and belittling. I cannot.
Okay.
To belittle and to bewildered. That so many people believe that this irrational rant. Yeah, I'm doing my best Moshe expression here. I figure if I can stutter and mumble, then I will be as qualified as Moshe, which is one of my great aspirations and life. I actually have exceedingly high regard for Moshe. Even worse than inferring that your God is a nincompoop through this verbal diarrhea, Christians somehow think that God withdrew the countless promises he had made to Yisrael and transferred them to Goyim. Now, I have a problem with that. Beyond the fact that if God did so, he would not be trustworthy. He would be as untrustworthy as the people who created him. But do you know that the overwhelming preponderance of promises God made to Jews are in our immediate future and thus yet unfulfilled? So for God to have made those promises and then to have changed his mind and say, oh, well, I didn't really like the way they behaved, suggests something that is really very bizarre. That means that God's prophecies are not even accurate of himself, because that would mean that he himself did not foresee that he himself would renege on those promises, because if he knew he was going to renege on them, he wouldn't have made them. Or if he knew he was going to change them, he would have prophesied that I'm going to change them.
You're a good debater. So, that's really cool.
Yeah. So you've got a serious problem here with this change thing, since the overwhelming percentage of them are promises that are fulfilled in the last day. In fact, one of the most famous is God saying that that he's going to renew his covenant relationship with Yisrael and Yehudah. And going to write his Torah inside of us, and that's going to be upon his return. If he is going to instill the Torah inside of us, it has not been replaced with a Christian New Testament. And if he is renewing relationship with Yisrael and Yehudah, it sure as hell isn't with the Roman Catholic
in the church.
Or Christian church. So, not only would such claims have made God a liar, would have made him an anti-Semite too, like cells, he would have been become completely untrustworthy, giving ever more credence to the realization that the religious gods are made in man's image. In reality, also, just putting a little common sense in this whole thing, it was the Romans who controlled Judea and who evolved into the Roman Catholic Church. And as bad as Jews have been, the Romans have always been far worse. Continuing to slander the chosen people on behalf of the worst people, we read, and besides, they were out of their minds. And they were surprised, saying, look, are not the entirety of them who are speaking Galileans? Pointing out the obvious again, the disciples were entirely Jewish, rendering this entire diatribe absurd. Galilee was used as a pejorative because it was a swampy, mosquito-infested lowland beneath Jerusalem in status and elevation. It was inserted to make the Jews in Jerusalem appear like snobs. That's kind of like me saying, I'm looking down upon you today, Kirk, as you're bobbing up and down there in Green Key Harbor. It's snobby. I mean, of course, I did it just to because it was a poor attempt at being funny. But no, they're trying to be serious. This dialogue demonstrates the inherent fraud that's associated with the Christian New Testament. at the very earliest, Acts was written 40 to 50 years after the fulfillment of Shavuot, well beyond the time a specific conversation could have been accurately recalled. Luke, its author, was not an eyewitness to any of these events, making his account hearsay. Moreover, pious Jews would have spoken Hebrew, not Greek. Further, the Roman legions which occupied Jerusalem were comprised of conscripts and slaves from throughout the empire. Under such circumstances, the sound of a foreign language would not have driven anyone crazy. Much of the Christian New Testament was written to include awkward and unattested conversations. Not only were they contrived, they were projected upon the entire population, all to condemn the Jewish people.
That's a fact. Yep.
Somehow, each and every one hears them speak in the distinct language and dialect of their birth. Parthians, Medes, Elamites, and those who live in Mesopotamia, Yehuda, Cappadocia, Pontus, and Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, parts of Libya, toward Cyrene, and visitors from Rome, not only Yehuda and newcomers, Grecians and Arabs, listening to them speak in their own tongue, that magnificent and powerful works of the God. Acts 2:8-11. It would have been absolutely impossible, even for the multilingual disciple and eyewitness, to know if this had occurred. The overall point is possibly true, at least devoid of the pretense of authenticity inherent in the details. Some of the most glaring issues include, however, that the Romans, they were not visitors, and Yehudim were listed twice. A little preoccupation on the Jews there. Most everyone in Mesopotamia would have spoken Aramaic, a language which is very similar to Hebrew, making Parthians, Medes, and Elamites verbose, while the absence of the Persians was a significant slight. Arabs speak a corrupted form of Hebrew. Similarly, insignificant places like Cappadocia, Pontus, Phrygia, Pamphylia, and Cyrene were listed. Well, the people responsible for the lingua franca of this religion, the Greeks were not.
Great.
Now,
great.
Just think it through, folks. Had this been written, the disciples, in addition to their native Hebrew, now spoke Greek, Latin, and Aramaic, it would have made far more sense, been more effective, and been credible. One would have been hard-pressed to find anyone in Jerusalem who was not conversant in one or more of these languages. Now, you might say, okay, you're being picky.
There's it's loud.
3 billion people, 3.5 billion people
3 billion.
That have had their souls robbed from them because they believe that this rubbish was inspired by God? And holding them accountable and saying, this is a pile of manure, it isn't true, and you want to say that I'm being picky and harsh? No.
We had that conversation yesterday.
I'm upset. God's upset. You should be upset. That's one of our problems.
Mm-hmm.
We're just afraid to hold people accountable. And listen, if somebody, scrapes my bicycle, I'm just not going to have a conniption fit of that. But if somebody harms, truncates billions of souls based on lies, then darn right, got a right to be upset.
And kill the souls of everybody's family. And nobody just stands up. Terrible.
In this passage, the Greek word apostolos is transliterated in most English Bibles as proselytes, then those who aided and abetted the misleading transliteration erroneously defined the word as converged to Islam, to Judaism, and thereby misconstrued Yahweh's intent. This day marked neither the birth of the church nor a transition from Judaism to Christianity, as Catholics and Protestants profess. More is, has there ever been a Judaizer, as Christians would have you believe? The benefits of Passover and Easter bread had been born anew from above, becoming these people who were the beneficiaries became spiritual children, adopted into Yah's family, fully seven Shabbat days ago. Now they were growing up, being enriched, enlightened, and empowered by the Torah's promises. They were being prepared for Teruah. There were no religious converts to be found here, only empowered and enriched relationships. Sporadically, from this moment to the present day, the Word of God has been carried to the peoples of the world by spirit-filled men and women who are cognizant of the Torah. Yahweh's family is inclusive of people from different races and places. Everyone is welcome, and we all arrive the same way, by embracing the covenant and observing its invitations to meet. This mikra, this invitation to be called out and meet of 50, is set apart, a special day for us to reveal the magnificent work performed by Yahweh through the set-apart spirit. It is an annual party where those related to Yah invite their friends to celebrate the good news. A path home has been laid out at great cost, its toll paid by God, so that we might journey free of encumbrances. This day of growth and enrichment will endure for all time, for all people, in all places, serving as a rehearsal of what was to come and now has been done. The Feast of Seven Sevens follows firstborn children by 7 weeks. The pattern is seven Shabbats plus one day after the special Shabbat observance of unyeasted bread, most essential day on the road to our redemption. As we have discovered, this opportunity to be called out and meet is a time to be enriched by Yahweh's word so that we can communicate his testimony more effectively during Teruah. It is open to all people, free and slave, Yehudim and Goyim, men and women, young and old, no matter how uncommon and or how common or how unclean. Very different from this presentation. This presentation was designed to divide people, and to particularly rather than bring Goyim who want to be part of Israel into a relationship with Yehuda, and having everybody feel welcome at this mikra. This was designed to make the Jews feel very unwelcome under this new religion. Unlike the Catholic Eucharist, which was limited to converts, this festival comes with an open invitation. Upon examining the letter and the spirit of this day, one comes to understand that the best way to broadcast its message and celebrate its inheritance is to host a grand party, replete with a melody of foods, including a variety of libations, and most especially breads and desserts, bread baked with yeast. Invite everyone who is interested in knowing God, whether they are engaged in a relationship with him, mired in a religious swamp, or deluded by a secular mirage. It's really interesting that after Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, where everyone who has capitalized on them has disassociated from religion and politics and become part of God's family, by Shabuah having yeasted bread as an integral part, God is saying, okay, you have foregone man's religions and man's politics to become part of my family. I want you to go back in there. Not to become one with them, but to communicate with them, to show how different you are. So we are now prepared because we made that distinction. We made that choice to disassociate ourselves from religion and politics, and God adopted us and enriched us and empowered so that we can now shine our light in the darkest place. And God knows we're not going to be corrupted by it, but he knows that for there to be more children in the covenant, that's where we must go. And that's why there is yeast in the middle of Shavuot. That is where, when we radiate Yahweh's light from being enriched by Shavuot, it shines the brightest.
Mm-hmm.
Each mikre has been designed to memorialize an important event in the life of Israel and to be prophetic of even more important events in the unfolding of Yahweh's redemptive plan. They speak poignantly of God's role in the reconciliation of his people, with detail after detail pointing directly and ambiguously towards the Torah as the map and the light along the way. Thus far, the first four mikre have been introduced and fulfilled in the proper order on the very day of its mandated celebration. Now, that fact alone makes the odds against their coincidental fulfillment over 16 billion to one. The lesson is pay attention to the dates and numbers as they are important to God. And if this pattern is important, pay attention. There are three more annual feasts to be realized. Won't they all take place as they are scheduled, just as the first three? Each of the remaining take place in the autumn, in the seventh and final month of Yahweh's redemptive calendar. Each predicts a strategic and essential event in the reconciliation of Israel and Yehudah with Yahweh. And more to the point, they complete the picture God is painting. The first three feasts have come and to pass. The fall feasts are yet to come. Yahweh has given us carefully drawn prophetic word pictures to teach us and the rest of the world the lessons we need to learn. Now, there's still much more to learn from this historical portrayal. Put that in effect. Now that I'm looking at my copy, I think I'm going to put historical portrayal of what happened during the fulfillment of Shavuot Shabbat in the year of its fulfillment in quotes, even if the primary lesson is to distrust the Christian New Testament. Acts 12:12. But also, all were astonished, perplexed, and puzzled, with different people saying to others, "What is the purpose of this?" Well, let's be honest. There is nothing everyone in Jerusalem agreed upon. Not among the Romans, not among the Greeks, and particularly not among the Jews. Yeah, this monolithic presentation of Jews is all conniving and arrogant and anti-God and anti-Jesus. It's just utter and complete nonsense. I mean, you want 10 different opinions? Ask three Jews. I've never agreed on anything. Painting it this way, it just shows that the people who wrote this, A, didn't know them, and B, were lying. I mean, the very history of Jews shows that Yehudim were divided among themselves. And it was their internal fractures which festered, bringing on the wrath of Rome upon Judea with Pompey's invasion in 63 BCE, Vespasian's assault in 67 CE, following the revolt in 66, and again following the Bar Kokhba uprising under Akiba by Hadrian in 133 CE. Anytime we read something that says, "with people saying," we know that the writer's sentiments are being projected upon his perceived foes. An actual quote would have to be attributed to a specific individual who said it and to another who heard it, in addition to proving and providing the names and conditions under which it was preserved accurately over the decades. And moreover, the Jews knew the purpose of Shavuot. It was the Greeks like Luke who were clueless. When it comes to knowing the mind of God, there are several paths a person can take. Some simply ignore the quest, preoccupied with their mortal existence, or overconfident that man is the highest form of life. Others, like the man who wrote this passage, do not know enough to draw an informed conclusion. And while both of these roads lead to death and to the destruction of one's soul upon the completion of their mortal existence, there is a far worse fate awaiting those who promote the false notion that Pentecost celebrates the birth of the church. There is no mention of a church in the Torah or in the prophets, only the Berith and Mikra. And we have been called out of man's world and into God's realm, away from religion and into a familiar relationship. Even today, the secular and the sectarian ridicule the Moed Mikre, belittling them, concealing them, and corrupting them, or counterfeiting them. It is why the narrow path to God remains so unpopular. They would have you believe that animal sacrifices, that's a thing of the past. That was primitive and cruel. Let me make this really clear. We are carnivores, we humans. As part of the carnivore group of animals, we need protein. We function on protein. Our brains thrive on protein. Our muscles thrive on protein. We need protein. And so we, like other animals, eat the flesh of animals. Provides protein. Man's been doing it for a very long time. The animal that dies and is eaten by another nourishes a life. It makes it possible for the lion to suckle her babies. It makes it possible for children to be born and to live. The animal is not making, the person who is preparing the animal to eat is not sacrificing the animal. They're devouring the animal. They're benefiting from the animal. And that is the way Passover is. You know, it's not that somebody goes off and takes a lamb and says, here, I'm going to give it to God. What, throw it up in the air and he can take whatever he wants? No. The lamb is mercifully prepared to be eaten. And then is cooked and then is served to the family. And only then are the parts that are unedible, that were not consumed. They're not even given to God. They're incinerated.
Mm-hmm.
There's no sacrifice here. There's a meal. Now, when Yahweh himself said, I'm going to be the lamb, and I'm going to provide the lamb, now he made a sacrifice. But not the individual lamb. Others now poked fun, scoffing, sneering, and mocking, saying, it is because they are exceptionally filled with new wine. If Luke had written about the correlation between the Torah's presentation of Shavuot and its fulfillment, rather than spending time trying to besmirch Jews as slanderous and demeaning, and there would be a point to this other than the obvious, which is not to trust him. And speaking of someone who did not trust him, Shimon, misnamed Petros in this account, stood up because we are called to confront lies, exposing and condemning them. We are never asked to be tolerant of deception. And that is why. But now Petros is Peter, Greek for rock, stood up with the 11. He raised his voice and he spoke to them, Yehudim, men, and all who dwell in Jerusalem, listen carefully to my voice and let this be known to you. By the way, I don't recall ever doing that. I've been associated with Yahweh now for 21 years. I don't ever recall standing on the street corner and saying, hey, all of you, listen to me. Ever. Make an idiot of myself, make an idiot of God, make a saint? No. That's not what God does at all. If somebody is interested, be prepared to tell them the truth. But don't go out to just people in general and say, listen to me. You know, wasting your breath, wasting your time, going to make people angry, you're going to gain nothing in the process. Now, this idea of street corner preaching is utter and complete nonsense, and that's what they have Shimon doing here.
Well, Yehudim never did that. Even today, they don't proselytize. They don't go out and try to gather the force. Number one, they don't trust them, and rightfully so. This proves that. So many other things. They just don't. So that's not even characteristic of Yehudim.
Correct. So, no, particularly
so
on character.
Yes.
Yeah. It was Paul, who is writing through Luke, is projecting onto Shimon, is what they're like.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This is what they would do. Now, in this particular...
He's supposed to be endorsing them, yeah.
Yes. Paul disowns his Hebrew name, as we know, Shaul. Not only because it was synonymous with Sheol, hell, but because of the many prophecies where he was called out by name and then condemned. As such, it served Paul's interest to change Shimon's Hebrew name, which means listen to him, to the Greek Petros for stone. Additionally, Paul both envied and despised Yosha's disciples, which is why his pal Luke referred to them as the 11 rather than by the title, disciple. The notion that Shimon's bothered to confront the alleged rumor of intoxication is not likely, especially to say it in the way he does, because he still infers that they were inebriated. It's just a little too early in the day. But at least we finally have something to investigate with the upcoming reference to Yoel. Joel. He says, because they are not drunk in the manner you suppose. That's like saying, you know, have you stopped beating your wife? No, they're not drunk in the manner you suppose. I don't know what manner they're drunk, but it's not the manner you suppose. It's not early in the day drink. For indeed, it is just the third hour of the day. I would tell you what, Kirk, when I trip over my own tongue, which I do regularly, he may be drunk, but he's not drunk in the way that you suppose.
No.
Because it's still early. Give him time. And then he'll be drunk in the way you suppose. Yeah. That would be a lovely defense.
Thank you. 4 o'clock somewhere.
Thank you, Stone. Yeah. To the contrary, this exists as the pronouncement of the prophet Yaol. To the contrary, what they're witnessing, people speaking in different languages here, is the fulfillment of the prophet Yaol. Why am I laughing? Well, the prophet Joel, he had one timeline that he spoke of, the last days, Yahweh's return. To say this is the fulfillment of Joel misses the time by a scant 2,000 years. And oh, by the way, Joel is talking about what happens on Yom Kippurim between Yom Kippurim and Sukkot. So he's got the wrong Moet
Mikra.
And he's off just by a smidgen, a couple of thousand years. I mean, so good grief. Yeah. Well, we are going to translate most of Yoel, and we will we'll go into it at great length. We're going to go into it at the time that it applies. It applies to Kippurim leading to Sukkah. It has nothing to do with Shavuot. Shavuot is the pronouncement of the prophet Moshe. If you want to talk about Shavuot prophetically, you need to listen to Moshe. There is nothing in Joel to explain seven Shabbats. It speaks of Yahweh's return in 6,000 Yah to fulfill Yom Kippurim. Therefore, if Shimon cited it as a retort to these supposed Jewish cynics, he was mistaken. It was the wrong Moed and the wrong time. And if Luke arbitrarily attributed this mistake to him, he demonstrated that he and his gospel ought not be trusted. Either way, Acts 2:16 is erroneous. According to Luke, Shimon is said to have quoted Joel 2:28 through 32. At least that is what is recorded in Acts 2:17 through 2:21. However, since Shimon did not deliver his rebuttal in Greek, even if it occurred, but instead in Hebrew, to accurately render what the prophet wrote and the disciple may have said, we will have to examine the original language, which is something we'll do during our review of these events pertaining to the Day of Reconciliations. So for now, here is that reading from the King James Version. And it came to pass in the last days. And it came to pass in the last days. I might be having one of those senior moments again, Kirk. What does it say here?
It says it shall come to pass in the last days.
In the last days. Well, did they think they were living in the last days?
Well, that's
and if they
implied.
Thought they were living in the last days, and they really weren't living in the last days, then guess what? They were wrong, weren't they?
Very much so.
So the very passage they're quoting says that it shall come to pass in the last days, and yet they're saying that pertained to their day. Now, it's okay to be mistaken, but it's not okay to be mistaken and pretend to be speaking the inspired word of God. Said God, I will pour out of my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your young men shall dream dreams. And on my servants and on my handmaidens, I will pour out on those in those days of my spirit, and they shall prophesy. Before I read the rest of it. Weren't we just told what happened here, that the sum of it is that they spoke in all these different foreign languages?
Yes.
Wasn't that the explanation? And they say, yet this explains it. Does this even mention speaking in foreign languages? Is there any mention here of Greek and Latin and any other language?
No, I've got it twice now. No, sir.
No. It speaks of being able to create prophecy, which means to speak accurately about the past, the present, and the future from God's perspective. Does it say anything other than prophecy, visions, dreams? Pour out my spirit and they shall prophesy. So by their own definition of what occurred, this does not apply. Wrong time, wrong mikra, and something entirely different. Yeah, wrong subject.
Wrong actions. Yes.
Yep. And I will shoo, it's going to be a really big shoo tonight. I will shoo really wonders big. And the heavens above. Were there any wonders shooed in the heavens above in 33 CE? Did that help explain what the people being perplexed because they were speaking foreign languages? It'll be a really big shoo in heaven tonight. And the signs in the earth beneath. Blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood. And there'll be a great and notable day of the Lord will come. And it shall come to pass that whoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. Well, the Christians, they repeat that last part, although they don't know the name of the Lord. But there was no blood, no fire, no vapor of smoke. The sun was not turned to darkness. The moon didn't turn to blood. How in the world did somebody like Luke write this and then billions of people believe that was inspired by God when none of it applied? Now,
well,
it's interesting.
How did the lexicons come up with it? How did the translations come up with this? And nobody ever says, wait a minute.
Let's not dispute that that's what the Hebrew, we're going to actually translate the Hebrew. But listen, when it comes to the fulfillment of Kippurim and Dode's return, it's going to be a bloodbath. This is going to happen. Nah. You know, the sky is going to be darkened. The moon's going to look blood red. The people are going to die in masses.
Huge numbers.
Yes. Fire, vapor of smoke. It's going to be an extraordinary time. So it's not so much that this is an errant translation of Yoel, as it is Yoel is about an entirely different event. None of these things happened then. And yet they put it here, and you don't have a single Christian say, whoops. These weren't the last days. The moon didn't turn into blood. The sun was not darkened. These signs in the heavens did not occur. And oh, by the way, no one called on the name of Yahweh.
No, not even a placeholder.
Right. So this was another nail in the coffin of the souls, known as the Christian New Testament. Even when its authors turned to the Torah and prophets for credibility's sake, they embarrassed themselves. This did not occur in 33 CE, but will in 2033. To understand Shavuah, we must turn to Moshe, not Yoel. Yoel's prophecy is spectacular, confirming many of the things that we have surmised while offering new insights regarding what we should expect. And this is all during this time from Kippurim to Sukkah. One of the things that I think is so marvelous in it is I became convinced that the story of Eden wasn't just about what happened 6,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. But it was far more about what's going to happen in
6,000 years.
Just a matter of 12 years from now. Mm-hmm. And that the whole story of the Mikre brings us back to where we began. That Sukkah is camping out with God in Eden. And so I figured that when Yahweh returns with those, they're going to transform this earth. They're going to cleanse it of all religious and political corruption, and they're going to transform it back into the conditions experienced in Eden. And guess what Yoel says? On one side, there is this enormous fire. On the other side, Eden awaits.
Wow.
So it is, I can't wait to translate it all and comment on everything that Yoel wrote. The prophecy is really spectacular. It just doesn't apply. Luke's late first century assessment of Shimon's protestation against his fellow Yehudim during the fulfillment of seven Shabbats concluded with him giving religious zealots who were mocking these events. And careful. Israelite men, listen to these words. Iusu, the Nazarene, is a man who publicly demonstrated to you that he is from Theos, using supernatural powers and abilities to form extraordinary miracles and prophetic significance. These are signs which Theos performed through him in your midst, as you know. Oh, this is just pathetic. First of all, at this point, keeping it real, the 10 tribes which comprised Israel were long gone, hauled off to Assyria as slaves. Therefore, it is very unlikely that Shimon would have used Israel as a designation. Having spent 3 years with Yosha, I'm just going to venture a guess here and say that Shimon probably would have known his name, rendering Iusu absurd. Iusu, Iusun, Iusus, the Greek variations of Yosha. You know, it doesn't share a single letter in common with Yosha. Mm-hmm. Even the Shin and Yosha is an SH, not an S, which would have had to have come from a Sin or a Shemek. Not one letter in common. Worse, Nazareth.
There ain't no Nazareth.
It didn't exist at
this
time.
No.
The town would not be established by that name until the 2nd or 3rd century. The designation Jesus of Nazareth conveys the wrong name and wrong place at the wrong time.
And that couldn't be the 1600s, because no Jesus.
No, that had to be written, the line, Iusu of the Nazarene had to be written by Eusebius. It could not have been written even by Luke, because Luke would not have known.
Oh, that's
that.
Right. That's right. 400, 4th century. Yeah.
Yeah. So 325-ish, when Eusebius would have started to describe Vaticanus and Sinaiticus, is when he added Iusu of Nazareth, because Luke would not have even known the name. The name didn't exist. It was Constantine's mommy that came up with it, and Eusebius was the chief bootlicker for Constantine, so he would have believed anything Constantine's mommy said. Yosha demonstrated that he was from God and proved it in their presence, as this states. There would have been no reason for this speech. If those among the hecklers had witnessed supernatural powers and extraordinary miracles, they would not be criticizing the disciple, but instead would be apologizing to him. Yet none of this would have made Yosha Theos God, as the passage concludes. Moreover, it was not the purpose of the Passover lamb to show off, and not God's nature to dazzle us with signs and wonders. His preference is to impress us with his words, of which we have almost nothing credibly retained from Yosha.
If Yahweh tells us that the Shemar Torah is his goal for our life, not what we do as a living, then what's so hard to understand that they keep throwing miracles at you? He said, I've written everything.
Right.
It was closed after the 40 prophets, you know, and it says everything is there and complete, lacking nothing. What's wrong?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the miracles and the words. Yeah, the miracles.
So why do you
need
the miracles?
The Torah and prophets
are
so brilliantly. The miracles and the words. And the Torah leads to the ultimate miracle of being born into Yahweh's family, becoming immortal, becoming perfected, being enriched and empowered. Those are the miracles, and the miracles grow out of the words. Mm-hmm. Now, with Calvinism's right in the West, this next statement is a problem, too. It says he was appointed to the prearranged and prophetic plan and purpose, Theos. So, was he was devoted to carrying out Pesach. And Pesach was the prearranged and prophetic plan and purpose of Yahweh. But there's no mention of Pesach, of the Pesach lamb, or of Yahweh. So that's a problem. And there's another little problem, too. Guess who wasn't even here for Shavuot? Yosha.
Mm-hmm.
Yosha has nothing to do with Shavuot. Yosha has to do with Passover. If this was the celebration of Passover, you could be all over Yosha. Yosha did this and Yosha did that. It was wonderful what the Passover lamb did for us. He fulfilled the prearranged and prophetic role. But he's nowhere to be found on Shavuot. He's gone.
Well,
had nothing to do with Shavuot.
He's not the Passover lamb.
Well, Yosha is the Passover lamb. He is not the fulfillment of Shavuot. He is not the set-apart spirit. Yeah. It's the set-apart spirit that is fulfilling Shavuot. If you want to talk about the God's impetus behind Shavuot, stop talking about the daggone Passover lamb. One and done. It's over. This has nothing to do with Yosha. Stop it, you idiots. God, you can't understand any part of the program.
Hmm.
What follows is as essential to Paul's claim that Christians replaced Jews because Jews betrayed God as it is errant in every regard. The purpose of the Passover lamb was to be the Passover lamb. And by the way, now we're talking about Shavuot. Had Yosha not served as the Passover lamb, there would be no hope of eternal life or reason to trust Yahweh. And oh, by the way, if we can't have our days be prolonged, what's the purpose of Matzah being perfected? What's the purpose of being adopted into Yah's family if we're going to curl over and die? What's the purpose of being God's children if we're going to stay dependent infants forever? And you move from one step to the next. We're not on step one anymore. We're on step four. He's talking about the fulfillment of Shavuot, and he goes right back into Passover. He was betrayed and given to the hand of the Torahless who chose to take control and lift him up, affixing him. Listen, if a modicum of Yehudim actually handed Yosha over to the Romans, then rather than blaming them and shaming them, we ought to be thanking them. Fulfilling Pesach was essential for us to live, and for that to occur, the lamb must die. Newsflash. Everyone, by the way, at this time was Torahless. The Jews turned to their Talmud, the Greeks turned to the Odyssey, the Romans to the Aeneid, the Christian to Paul's epistles. There wasn't anybody who was observant of the Torah. Now, while the word for affixing him was prosopagnomi, it's almost always translated or rendered crucify. But this Greek word simply means to affix and to fasten. I bring that to your attention because the Roman cross and its piercing nails were irrelevant. Christianity has made a religion out of an inanimate object. It is like crediting the knife for the Yahzeh Exodus. The fulfillment of Passover is about the who, the where, the why, and the when, not about the how or even the what. It is an interesting aside, and it's worth noting that the preponderance of Catholic sculptures and paintings depict Yosha in one of two ways, as a helpless infant attached to his mother, or helplessly attached to a cross. It is as if the Catholic hierarchy has chosen to control him in these ways. They are quietly saying, if he cannot take care of himself, why would you trust him to take care of you? And that leads to, trust us instead with your soul.
Wow.
Theos restored him to life and raised him, releasing and dismissing him from the suffering and pain of death, because it was not possible for him to exist held and influenced by these things. On the contrary, the Passover lamb is never restored to life. The Pesach Ael does not make this sacrifice to save itself. Yosha's body suffered the full impact of what the Romans mercilessly inflicted. He was not released or dismissed from the pain. And as we know, the excruciating anguish was perpetrated by the Romans, who became Roman Catholics, not Jews. There are a few things as challenging to understand, or insightful, when understood, than what actually transpired on Pesach, on yeasted bread and firstborn children as it relates to Yosha's body, Yahweh's soul, and the set-apart spirit. Those who have been with us from the beginning know that Yahweh honored his promise to provide the lamb by placing his nephesh, his soul, in Yosha. Upon completing Passover, the set-apart spirit took Yahweh's soul to Sheol upon the death of Yosha's body. What remained of the Passover lamb was incinerated later that night in accordance with Yahweh's instructions. Then during unyeasted bread, a Shabbat in 33 CE, Yahweh's soul endured Sheol to redeem us, keeping us from being separated from himself. Having paid our penalty, the set-apart spirit freed Yahweh's soul from the place of separation, fulfilling firstborn children. The apostles' alleged Shavua soliloquy was advanced by way of a second Tanakh citation. This one from the 16th Mizmor Psalm. But so as to better understand why he may have selected it, let's begin our examination by studying the entire song from which the excerpt was taken. Shimon would not have cited it in a vacuum, so we should not approach it out of context either. It begins, a poem of Dode, a poem concerning Dode. It's Mitkam La Dode. Watch over me and be concerned about me, God, because in you I confide and trust, so I am kept safe and comforted. Mizmor 16:1. It's a lovely presentation.
Oh, great line.
Psalm,
yes.
Yeah, Psalm concerning Dode. Watch over me and be concerned about me. Shamar Ani. God, because in you I confide and trust, and I am kept safe and comforted. The contrast is between trust and faith. Trust is the result of knowing, while faith is its substitute. Dode, as the exemplar of knowing, is God's chosen one. Paul, the advocate of faith, became the plague of death. Shimon may have cited Dode's psalm to make this very point, but I... Dode knew where and with whom he stood. He said, I say to approach Yahweh, you are my foundation and support. I have nothing to offer which is worthwhile or useful apart from you. Well, that's pretty cool. Now, this is the most qualified individual who ever lived, the most brilliant man in human history, the most articulate ever, probably the most handsome individual who ever lived, the most brilliant, the greatest poet and songwriter, I think overwhelmingly the most interesting prophet. King of Yah's people. He is God's chosen shepherd. He is the Son of God. He is the Messiah. And this dude says, I have nothing which has any value that didn't come from Yah.
That's a leader. Yeah. A humble pie.
Well, no, it's not humble at all. It's just
easy. No, for us.
It's humble pie, right?
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yes, absolutely.
I mean, if you combined you and me together and multiplied that by a few billion,
we
might be there to tie Doge laces on his sandals. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe if we had Jackie Ann and a few others and Leia
and Mike telling us we did it wrong.
A few more people we'd be close, but. You know, here's the most remarkable person in the world, and he's the most remarkable person in the world because he realizes that apart from God, he's nothing. And that's true for all of us. Apart from God, we're nothing.
Absolutely.
But the minerals which comprise our bodies, our souls, are fleeting. They die and they evaporate to nothing. There's nothing of us other than the memory of us should we not associate ourselves with Yahweh. So everything that we have is from Yahweh.
Yeah.
And if that is true for Dode, and it was, it's much, 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 much more true for us.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful lesson for us to learn. What a nice line for Shimon to quote, but he didn't do it. Dode found pleasure in knowing that we would capitalize upon what he had written to lead others to this same place. He says, regarding the set apart in the land who show the way to the relationship, they are also awesome. And in them is all of my satisfaction and enjoyment. So he's not contradicting himself here. He's saying that everything that I have that's worthwhile comes from Yahweh. But the thing that really makes me the happiest, that provides my satisfaction, is knowing that the set apart, those who have set themselves apart to Yahweh, become part of his covenant, that those who are engaged in showing the way to the relationship, they are really awesome. They're marvelous. They're worthy. And in them is all of my satisfaction and enjoyment. That's my greatest joy.
Wow.
That's pretty cool. So here is the guy that we admire most, that Yahweh loves the most, and he's saying that his greatest joy in life is knowing that his words have caused many of us to be set apart unto God and to be committed to showing the way to the relationship and the benefits of that relationship, and that is what makes Dode happy.
Well, thanks, Big D.
Yeah, and guess what? If it makes Dode happy, guess who else it makes happy?
Makes Yahweh happy.
You betcha. Dode's
dad. Makes all of us happy as well.
That's right. In contrast to those who would join him in their approach to Yahweh, Dode realized that most people would be led astray, chasing after gods made by men. The sorrows and sufferings of those who are impetuous and who chase after another will be great, as they will be numerous and influential. Their drink offerings I will never pour nor offer. I will not advance or promote their names on my lips. So God says, here's the inspired prophet, and Dode says, my greatest joy in life is knowing that there will be those who are set apart, special to God, who will be committed to sharing the way to achieve the benefits of the relationship. And yet, by contrast, there will still be the impetuous who chase after another, who chase after something different, who will live through an anxious and anguishing life. And those people will actually be the most influential. They'll be the most numerous, they'll recognize. But he says, their drink offerings of blood. What is a drink offering of blood?
Well, it's always the Last Supper thing. It's my blood, Catholics.
Roman Catholic Church, that's the Eucharist.
Yes, that's right.
You know, this is the blood of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And so the drink offerings of blood is I ain't never going to participate in that stuff. And, oh, by the way, the names of their gods and the names of their institutions, their Holy Father, their Roman Catholic Church, their Iesu Christu, he said, nope, not going to hear those names on my lips. Good for him. No wonder these Christian types don't like Dodd and are robbing him of every gift that God offered him. He was, he had their number.
Boy, did he.
Yeah, and really, the
really
choice
prophetic.
Here is between...
That's so prophetic. I mean, really, yes.
Yeah, he had their number. Yeah. You know, the choice is between Dodd and Paul, between Yahweh and Jesus, between the Torah and the New Testament, a relationship or religion, life or death. This is the contrast. Dodd presented it clearly, which is why they have to rob him. And, you know, there isn't a single prophecy in which Yahusha is named. Not one. And yet there are 1,000 in which Dodd is named. He is named in all of them. And you read them and it says, this is what I'm promising to do with Dodd. At one point, God even says, if everything that I have said as a promise regarding Dodd does not happen, you can call me a liar.
I'm a liar, yeah. I'm a liar.
Yeah.
Call me a liar.
Like God's trying to get our attention. No, I'm not changing.
Yes.
I am not changing. This is my guy. I'm committed to him. God is really proud of Dodd. He loves him with flaws and everything. Loves his passion. Loves his intellect. Loves his articulate nature. Loves his poetry, his song. God thinks his son is beautiful. He even says it. God's a proud father when it comes to his son. A proud father. And if you're a proud father and somebody demeans your child, you get angry with them.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the Christians have done by besmirching Dodd to transfer all of these promises to their Iesu Christu. We'll read one more and then of this,
okay.
And we'll pick up the 16th Psalm. And I want to tell you, it gets, this is so much more interesting as we move through it, because Luke is going to put words in Peter's mouth, whereby Peter twists the Samuel 7:11 and 2 Samuel 7. And I had thought that the last time I translated, I had finally come to terms with what that prophecy actually says. And yet, this time through, oh my. And I wasn't prepared to fully understand it until a mutual friend of ours, the fact checker of Yada
mm-hmm.
Yada, said, you know, I think there's reason to celebrate Bukhuram, the day after a natural Shabbat following matzah. And I'd always seen it as 3 days in a row. And that matzah is the ultimate Shabbat, the ultimate expression of the Shabbat. And so there are so many references where it says akar, Shabbat, and akar is translated, rendered, the day after. But that's not what the word means. The word means hesitate, delay, be inactive, vacillate, and by doing those things, being left behind. So what it really says is don't vacillate, don't delay on the Shabbat or you're going to be left behind. So when it comes to capitalizing on the opportunity of Chag Matzah, don't hesitate. The opportunity is now. Capitalize on it. And so you might say, so why am I bringing that up now? Because when there is a change of voice in 2 Samuel 7, it goes from God talking to Dode to God talking of Dode. And it's the same thing that happens in the 110th Psalm. It's the same thing that happens in each of these texts that they bring up. God goes from talking about Dode, to Dode, to about Dode. So he calls him you when he's talking to him, and he calls him he when talking of him. And so rather than saying that after you, someone's going to arise, it says that, you know, Dode didn't hesitate. He didn't vacillate.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you recognize that that's the nature of this transition, all of a sudden that prophecy goes, oh my, God is telling us something marvelous about his son and the role his son can play in our lives now and the role he will play in our lives in the future.
Yeah, 2030.
And I would never have known that had it not been for the need to translate and really analyze the verbal roots of each of these words that comprise the God's presentation of the Mikra. If we didn't have our fellow brothers and sisters in the covenant bring up these things and challenge us this way, we never found them.
Mm-hmm.
And if I hadn't found that one, I never would have come to this complete understanding of 2 Samuel 7. And it's marvelous when we get there. And even more marvelous when we get to the psalm that the Christian New Testament corrupts the most, which is the 110th. And we're just going to marvel as to whether or not Christianity renders everyone unable to think, or if this is a deliberate scam knowingly perpetrated by Christians over the decades and the millennia. And I don't know really the answer to that one. I'm gonna pose it, but one of those two things is true. Either their perceptions are so obviously wrong, so contrary to what God said, one of two things is true. Either religion has rendered all of them unable to think, or the leaders have done this deliberately, knowingly, making it murder. So we'll pick it up this time next week with more of an analysis of Psalm 16. We will go directly into the part that Luke corrupted to advance his view. But what we're ultimately going to see is that they want to present Dode as dead and buried and excluded from heaven. And then they want to have the same guy that is dead and buried and done with and excluded from heaven being the voice that announces the presence of their Lord, Jesus. So, it's not very clever, but that's what's there. So I hope that when we're all done with this, too, we can add it to Volume 4 of Questioning Paul, because it really does a marvelous job of exposing the fraud that is the Christian New Testament, and particularly the books written by Luke.
Yeah, it is.
So, Kirk, I wish you a good night's sleep on Kara. I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Have a wonderful night. And to all of you out there in Yah's beautiful universe, may Yah bless you all, and Shabbat Shalom. Good night.
Shabbat Shalom. Good night.